Good morning.
Morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
See. So thank you all for coming. It's my honor to be here to have the opportunity to speak to you today. I'm going to try to kind of set the tone for the day a little bit. So I'm assuming most of you in here write code for a living or have a friend that do so, and you're here in their seat instead of them because they slept late. So what we're going to try to cover is why you develop what you develop, and give you an idea on how we see the market changing over time, quickly, just this one session. And the rest of the day, you're going to get a lot of hands-on how detail. How do I write this code? How do I design for this style of computing? What are the devices that maybe I should be choosing to develop for? And what clouds can I use to back those kinds of services? So, quickly, I'm coming from about 12 years at Microsoft today. I started out doing Windows. So anyone in the room ever done kernel development before? Some of my people are here, not too many. So I started out doing kernel debugging for Windows 2000, way back when. I moved on to become an architect at Microsoft for a few years. I took a small break and led some business organization stuff for a little while, mostly our work with independent software vendors, a lot of you guys in the room today. And then I'm back in Redmond at corporate headquarters trying to figure out what is in the cloud for us. So what is it that is the cloud style? What are the APIs that you have access for? What kind of patterns make sense to do based on whether you're doing media services, file storage backup, whether you're an IT shop trying to modernize some of your infrastructure, or whether you're an ISV trying to create the next Facebook? So what I'm going to talk about today are the trends. I will have a demo. I promise to show code. Hopefully I never do a talk without oversharing code. And I'll try to show you a little bit on the kind of different UIs to get some thinking about what you can do instead. So without beating around the bush too much, let's get started. So there's kind of two things in the world today in software. And they change quite a bit from what they used to be. So up here we see devices and services. So devices are things inclusive of your car. There's a lot of smart devices out there today that outnumber us in this room by a good margin. There's things like phones. Most people in the room today probably have a smartphone. That smartphone's compute capacity exceeds a $31 million mainframe from 40 years ago. And that's in your pocket, and you might have paid nothing, or it's a subsidized price, or it's probably below $400 US. So that computing power can be harnessed now for a whole different series of solutions, especially combined with the networking that we assume is present in most places in the world, and Taiwan especially has a very mature marketplace with very high-speed networking, so you guys can build some amazing applications. The other part you'll see there are services. So services is a way of trying to describe things that help other things do something interesting. So in the modern world, really, that's cloud services, because we assume that the amount of data required to get the application on your device to work and do interesting things is beyond what you can store even on a local device. So anyone know how much data there is in the world? I'm going to try to get this interactive if I can. So until about 2003, from 8,000 BC, so pre-Egyptian all the way until 2003, there were 5 exabytes of data. That includes every book ever written, every song ever sung, every video ever created. Between 2003 and 2013, we've generated another 8 exabytes of data. So it took us a little over 8,000 years to get to the first 5. It's taken us less than 10 to get to the next 5. And that's accelerating. We're actually increasing the amount of data we create over time. So the only way that can be harnessed and used by people like you writing code for a living are services. So happily, you guys apparently agree because you've come to talk about cloud and listen about cloud and learn about cloud, and that's all about devices and services. So you are here. You're kind of the third bucket right now. The size of the circle indicates relative to the globe, which you think of the globe represents how many people there are in the world. The size of the circle around it indicates how many devices there are in the world. And one way to count a device is, does it have an IP address? Right? So we exhausted IPv4 addresses several years ago. Inside of Microsoft's firewall, we ran out of IP addresses over 2 years ago. We were one of the early companies in the internet, so we got a big allocation of IPs. Those were all gone. So we had to go to IPv6 a while ago. But you can see already, we're going to have five times as many devices as there are people. And I think the definition of device is going to shift over time. We'll start seeing things that share IP addresses. For example, home automation is a very popular space for a lot of companies. But home automation, you might have six or seven different devices in the home feeding signals and data into a device that then shares it to the cloud. That would show up to the cloud as one device, but behind the scenes, there's multiple devices to it. So the idea here is the only way we can orchestrate and show value on these things is through rendering out large-scale services. And happily, the cloud, every 6 months, doubles in compute capacity. I'll say that again. The worldwide cloud doubles compute capacity about every 6 months. So it's massively growing, which means there's an amazing opportunity for you guys in the room to do some amazing stuff. So one thing to just get agreement on is, if you have a device in your hand, it's probably only interesting to look at if it's connected to something else, right? We've all seen social networks explode. It's gone from blogging back. Remember when people wrote things on the internet, actually wrote things, like large amounts of sentences, and you would actually read them? Now it's gone to three or four sentences, and now it's Twitter with 140 characters, and now it's Pinterest with just pictures. And I guess pretty soon we're just going to be putting colors and smiley faces because we keep getting shorter and shorter time bands for doing things. But the amount of data attached to that is enormous. So in our case, 9 out of 10 times, whatever you do that's interesting, that people pay you to do, or you pay yourself to do, or you want to do because it's fun, will be connected to a large-scale service. And we're going to talk about how you can harness that power today. So when we translate devices and services, let's talk about it in pretty concrete terms. So for us, we at Microsoft, we've done a decent job about creating operating systems for a few years. Windows has gone through a lot of changes over the years. It's gone from being something a consumer would only use, but really serious business wouldn't, to something that serious business bet on, into something that now we're trying to repenetrate the consumer market with having Windows have some core characteristics. One thing a lot of people don't realize is Windows Phone today has the same kernel code that Windows PCs have. The kernel on your PC is the same kernel that's present on your server. The server in your data center has the same kernel on it that we run Windows Azure on, and that's the same kernel that's going to be in Xbox One. So you start seeing how we're lining up to really lower the bar on how many devices you need to develop for, and you can get more and more skill reuse and more code reuse over time. And that's what we're trying to do on the top there with PC and hardware. So we're trying to align that to make the deployment as easy as we can. We're trying to learn from the pain that Google's going through with Android on having so many devices and so many runtimes to support. And on the bottom side, the whole point is, no matter what your PC, your tablet, or your phone operating system is, of course we're going to show Windows at the top, that even if it's something from someone else, we want you to have the same exact cloud service. So no matter what, the thing that does the heavy lifting, the thing that does the AI in your game, the thing that does the clever things around orchestration for your business processes, or the thing that does the clever things about retail price optimization, if that's your product, all those things will be a durable service written once, and you'll have different UIs depending on the device you're going to render against. So that's the core tenets for how we're going to think about moving forward. And there's kind of three things underneath what we call new experiences. The first one, we have a picture of the Kinect version 1. So when we first prototyped Kinect, it came out of our research labs in Cambridge. It was about a $15,000 device. So what you see there was about $15,000. It had duct tape. It had paint all over it. It kind of sat crooked on this little stand. But it would be able to render 3D topology from a camera and a sensor. It's about $149 today. And it's both used in gaming and it's used in PCs. And we're building it into the base assumption for gaming going forward because the most natural way that people interact with objects, which is a very common thing you do in games, it's through 3D motion of arms and face, and we're adding finger support for higher resolution. So I'll show in a little bit an example what a company called Coca-Cola is trying to do to use that to sell sugar water, which is what Coca-Cola is. But they're making the experience exciting for people. The next step we talk about is connected. So when I say connected, I mean from device to device. The scenario that we're proving out is I'm walking down the hall watching a movie on my Windows phone. I sit down on my TV, it repurposes the display on my television. I get up and I walk further down the hallway and sit in front of my Xbox device, and it resumes the movie from where it played off. So the device has to be smart about the context and how I'm using my things, in this case video, and it's also just be smart about the rights and permissions and licensing attached to these things. Because as you know, not everything is available everywhere. And the hardest scenario for us to support, you guys have given us pretty strong feedback on, is imagine I'm watching a movie before I get on my plane in the United States. I land in Taiwan and I open the movie back up and I can't stream it in Taiwan due to usage rights. And that's a business problem that we're trying to help solve to allow the technology to flow. But that's connected. And the last part is personal. It's not that interesting to log into a site that only gives you 10 blue links when you type a search. It's much more interesting if you understand that your friends like this site more than this site, or people like you prefer this site versus this site, or this particular location has things that you want in it because it's where you're closer to it. So we change the order in how things are presented. That's kind of a search scenario. But when you get up to personalization, it also includes things like it understands what applications you have permissions to. So based on that, it can make other offers to you and connect to other systems. So one side we have, how do I feel about it? That's the natural interface. Can I use it very naturally? The next one is, can I get to it via software? So networking has to be in play, as well as the customization of the API set. And the third category we're talking about, making it something that you feel emotion from. So those are the three things that really have to be present to change how people interact with things. One of the quick things I'll call out is, when you have touch UI on something, you're 2.5 times more likely to share the content that you're looking at. It's kind of odd how people interact with things. When people go to a store, you'll notice that a certain segment of people, even if they're not going to buy the product, they walk up and they touch it. And they go, and they walk away. Well, they didn't come back and buy it later. Some people are very tactile. And you know what those people are called? They're called users, right? So they've been waiting for a while to be able to touch things. So that's when you'll see a lot of what we're doing in Windows, Xbox, on the Windows Phone, all that is based on the touch experience. And we've gotten pretty strong feedback that that's the right direction to go on, while still preserving the ability to move quickly for power users with mouse and keyboard. So let me show this example real quick. It's only about a minute video. It's kind of cool to watch how people interact with something. The first thing to call, the thing in the background is a Coke machine. It's a Coke machine with some video screens on it. And I don't know how you guys are in Korean pop music here, but there's a band there called 3PM in the background, which apparently is quite popular. And they put this Coke machine in a mall. They partnered with the band to put together some dance videos. And if you can dance like they're dancing on the video, you get a free Coke. The moves get harder and harder as you go. So think Dance Dance Revolution. Rock of Ages hero kind of thing with guitar, except the more you dance, the more Coke you get, but only if you do it right. So it's actually a pretty complicated computer science problem. How does the Coke machine know that they're actually doing the right maneuver? And I did check, there is no one hidden inside of the Coke machine doing it anyway. At the very top, you can see a camera they use for recording, but behind the screen, they have a Kinect device. So Kinect is powering this experience for Coca-Cola, and they did it as a way to see how people would be willing to interact in order to gain access to a major brand product like Coca-Cola. So let's see if we play. I think she's a plant. And there we go. So they've been selling sugar water for over 100 years, right? So there's nothing special in the product. There's a lot of brand connotation about the experience that they're leveraging and trying to get to a new channel through software. And I think you guys will find that there's a lot of traditionally non-software businesses that are trying to do that today through media presented on the internet. And a lot of those do it through ads and search capability today. More and more over time, the experience will become natural on how you make money off your application and how you blend in product capability. So be thoughtful on how you change how people work with your product. Because when you think about it, buying the Coke really has no software component to it unless you change the experience. So that's what I wanted to land with that. So here, now that we've talked about changing the experience, now you gotta get to the experience, and how do I access to users? So what I tried to carve out is kind of the big four buckets for the kinds of users that have the most traction in them around the software business, that have the most opportunity for a lot of you guys from a commercial point of view. So on the left, we have Windows 8, and a lot of that's about touch UI and fluid environment, and we're trying to change how people interact with Windows to be much more modern and use the touch metaphor all over the place. And you guys will hear a lot about that today. In just a little bit, we'll create a Windows application that's touch-enabled out of the box. And I think the last time I timed it, it took me 5 minutes to create a Windows application back to the cloud. So we'll do that. The next is the Windows Phone, which uses a lot of the same UI. So when you design for Windows, which has about 1 billion users, you get access to Windows Phone, which has slightly less than 1 billion users, but the same experience and the same code base, most of it. And then we go to Xbox, where we also want to offer the same connected experience. And then the odd one here, and that's more around Windows embedded scenarios, not necessarily just R. So one of the most popular operating systems in use for things like CAT scans, PET machines, a lot of things in manufacturing processes, like automated switches for buildings for power and cooling, and in cars, in the case of Ford Sync, are Windows embedded. And the reason is because it's easy to use the skill set, right? It's much lower barrier to try to learn this flavor of something than to learn something brand new. So we're working as hard as we can to make sure the APIs are aligned, the experience is aligned, and then the business optimizations are aligned. So let's get right into developing for Windows 8 and Windows Phone. So HTML5 has been promised for many, many years by many, many companies. It's one of those standards things that never seems to be done. A lot like 802.11n took forever to get done on the networking side. HTML5 has been taking many, many years for us to finish up when it comes to the standard side. So Microsoft's been participating in the standard body, trying to get something that can generate powerful scenarios, and it's getting really, really feature-rich. So we made a bet about 3.5 years ago at this point that the default development environment for Windows 8 is going to be HTML5 and JavaScript. We don't own HTML5, and we don't own JavaScript. And that's what we're saying is the basis for how developers will write code for our flagship operating system. When we go to Windows Phone, since it was out before Windows 8, before HTML5 was even as close to date as it was when we started on Windows 8, which wasn't very big at all, we had to make a decision on XAML as the way that people supported things, given the traction that XAML had in the marketplace. But over time, you'll find the development methodologies to line up pretty cleanly. So over time, these things will be very clean for you guys to right-click in Visual Studio, deploy for Windows, right-click in Visual Studio, deploy for Windows Phone, and hopefully very soon right-click and deploy for Xbox. So that scenario we think is very, very powerful for you guys because it's driving you crazy, we hear a lot, that you have to write different code, different testing, and different deployment packages depending on where a customer wants to use your product. You want to write it once and have them consume it anywhere. This is what we're trying to do to line it up. So we get kind of the core tenets for Windows 8 here. The new one for a lot of people is ARM and x86-64 support. Writing for ARM is different than writing for x64 and x86 instruction sets. So we decided to abstract that away. So you don't have to write ARM-level primitives because we wrote all the APIs to try to remove that from the need to do it. It takes a lot of work to do it, especially if you write lower level things, like a lot of people don't realize that Excel uses assembly code to do optimizations of cell formulas. Well, if you're writing the assembly code level, now you're writing the chip processor and register, so now you have to port all that code. So it took us a little bit to get there, but it's going pretty well. We think ARM is a low power utilization scenario. It makes a ton of sense for a lot of people. It's where the market is when it comes to mobile devices. But we also noticed that x86 with Intel, with the Haswell chipset, is really catching up. So we see about a 50% power improvement with Haswell. We hope to see similar improvements even on ARM processors as we move forward. But those are kind of the big four. The one I want to call out separately, even though it's not a technology discussion necessarily, is the integrated store. It's kind of a big deal being able to write your thing and then sell it. And you can sell it on your own and keep there all the money that you make, of course. But when you say, okay, now I want to go to a store, like an app store, a Play Store, or the Microsoft Store, now how does the commerce for that work? How does the customer discover it? How do they try it? And then how do they buy it if they like the product? So that's where we've been spending a lot of time the last year or so. We love your feedback over the next few days. Hopefully, even today, when you guys get a chance to try some code and to play with things while we're presenting to you. But the store hopefully turns into a vehicle for you guys to really get the experience of Windows to Windows Phone all the way to Xbox. So I talked about this a little bit. The one thing I want to hit on is the native games. Do we have any games developers in the room? There's a couple of you guys. I know you are. You're shy. So, we have a few. So, on the game side, we still offer native hardware access for Windows 8. We still offer for Windows. We still offer for Xbox. And I would be surprised if we ever don't offer native access. Because when it comes to games, typically the first thing you want to do is direct access to the hardware. And that's an important component for how we do Windows Phone, Windows 8, and Xbox. But the other thing that makes that enabled for you guys is the common programming model. So when you do native, depending on the platform, there'll be different APIs, but the way those APIs work is really standardized across the platforms. So let's kind of show a little bit what I was talking about and build a quick Windows application. So what we're going to create quickly is an application that uses Azure Web Services that connects up a Windows 8 application on my notebook, although create and deploy local to my notebook, that is connected live to a SQL Azure database in the cloud and uses websites to handle the notification services, the data consistency, and all the deployment do for me. So for any of you guys that have done virtual machine-based cloud stuff before, I think you'll find this to be pretty interesting on how fast and how easy it is to go from an idea to a finished application that you can iterate against. So let's make it happen. So let me shut down the presentation. And let's go to Azure. So I'm going to log into the Azure Developer Portal. And the idea here isn't that this is what a large IT organization would use to manage their cloud infrastructure. It's the way a developer would gain access to self-provisioned resources to be able to write things. Or a small development team would be able to use shared instances of things to begin their development process. And the feedback we've gotten on the portal has been pretty positive. I think we're on version 2, version 3. Move this over. Duplicate. Survey says, so what I've done is I've just logged into the portal. I went to azure.com. I click portal. It lands me here. So these are the services I currently have deployed. And these are the kinds of menu items that you could select from. And we'll talk in a little bit about what a building block service is and how we do service layering and how we compose things on the fly. But you can think of these are my big building blocks for the kinds of things I would stack together to form an end-to-end solution. So what we're going to try to do is create a website, mobile web service. There we go, mobile services. And what should we call it? Any ideas? Oh, you guys are shy. So I'm going to call it just Taiwan Azure Day. And I'm going to actually create a new database as part of this. And you'll note that there's a 20 megabyte SQL database free by default. And then there's a new SQL database instance. So it'll take an existing database and just add a database on top. I'm going to choose the free one just because it deploys slightly faster. But one of the pieces of power here out of the box is you don't have to write a lot of custom script control where things go and how they're provisioned. We do all that for you. So here I'm going to choose East Asia, which will be our Singapore data center. You notice it added an underscore DB, so it helped me with some naming on things. My service is Taiwan Azure Day, it's underscore DB. And now I can choose a server I already have or create a new one. You can see I already have it as SQL data that I'm using in West US. And also have one in East Asia I'm already using. I'm just going to create a new database from clean just to show you guys that the experience is still just as fast. And let me add a login that I can remember. That's my name. Let's see if I can type the password. Ooh, caps lock, see? Nice. You gotta love this typing. All right. Yeah, when doubt, start. Caps lock on, caps lock off. Whatever. There we go. Huzzah, it works. Okay, so in the background, what's happening is we received a REST call request. So whatever you do in this UI, you can do via REST interfaces from your own services. We give you all the APIs to do so. You can write PowerShell scripts to do it if you like. You can write Perl scripts to do it if you like. You can write a PHP application to do it. You can use Java to do it. But the key thing here is this is meant to make it an easy way to spin up and monitor services. So we gave you kind of an easy UI on top, which is HTML5 based. So we've received a request. We're provisioning an actual SQL Server service. That's a lot of S's in a row. But it's a service. It's not a virtual machine. That's going to, when in doubt, always sort in three different places at once. The three places will be guaranteed to be separated by at least one network fault layer. So we'll try to get across two different network segments. And we'll also guarantee that at least one of those is across a different rack, so it's a different physical fault domain. And by default, we'll set up a replication to the other data center. So if this instance was spun up in Singapore, our paired data center right there is the data center in Hong Kong. And if this was in Hong Kong, the paired data center is Singapore. So the idea is your data is always available to you, which enables for the first time you to start doing things like, why am I doing this questions? So a lot of the backup restore that we have today is because things go down, you think about a place when you write applications. Now we want to be thoughtful about the style for creating an application. And the style of cloud means that it's already replicated in several places already. So it's difficult to come up with a scenario with a brand new application where backup and restore is necessary. It's already backed up, it's already available, clustering is already done for you, and all that's been happening while I've been talking. So the service is already deployed, and let's take a look at what we got. So here's my Taiwan Azure Day. It gives me a nice little landing page for getting started, and it's gonna give me some help. And you'll notice a few things here. One is it's defaulting to Windows Store, because I use typically Windows Store applications when I develop. But there's also Windows Phone 8, there's iOS, there's Android, or there's a default HTML5 in JavaScript. So if you wanted to create a website that hosted the service, it would be the exact same steps that you would do, but you use the skill set that you know how. So if you had an iOS development environment, and this was on Mac, I would go into iOS, and I'll pull up my default editor there, and just go nuts and create the website. It'll be about as quick to do as it is for us in Visual Studio. But let me take a look at the store example. And let's create a new SOAR application. So I have Visual Studio already installed. Just understand that if you don't have Visual Studio 2012, we have the free edition link right here. You click on that, it'll actually begin the install process, and you have the free version with all the tools, APIs, and documentation pre-configured. But I'm gonna go right to creating some default tables. So in this case, my application takes to-do items. Like, here's the five things I need to get done today. It's going to create that list in an application. It's going to push it to the cloud. And I can have multiple other applications pulling from that list via notifications and synchronization services. Other people can be deleting items off there or marking them complete. Think of this as a very dirt simple way to handle item lists for a small development team. Maybe that's the scenario we'll go with. So we're going to create a toolbox table. It's going to do a quick little bit of thinking. What it's doing now is deploying the schema to the database. It's a very simple schema, a couple of columns, and a gonna do it not. There it's created. And now I have an easy way to download some boilerplate code. And I can choose either C# or JavaScript. I'm gonna choose C# because I'm a .NET guy by background. And it's gonna do something really fancy, like give me a zip file. And there's my zip file. And one of the first things you'll notice that's new, maybe for some old school Microsoft guys, is NuGet. So we're all over Git as far as how you do source code synchronization, how you do deployment, packaging, repository management. That's the default behavior for our website services because that's the number one source repository for a lot of people to do web applications. You can use whatever you want. This is the one that our little sample app will generate for you on the fly. So let me go ahead and grab this code. Let me drag it local to my machine. I have a code directory. And let me just start the solution. It was auto-generated for me. So I'm running Ultimate Edition 2012 because sometimes I like showing the testing tools. And it's update 3, which is maybe a month old or so, I think, at this point. So one of the feedbacks we got was, boy, it takes Visual Studio a while to ship. And it seems like there's all these new features coming all the time. You guys should pick up the speed at which you ship Visual Studio. And we have the idea of update 1, update 2, update 3 now, since Visual Studio 2012 shipped, which, as you might guess, was about a year ago. We've already reshipped 3 times to adjust to new feature sets. And there's updates available today. All right. So let me show you guys really quickly what is in the application. So here's my C sharp file. Let's make this a little bit more readable. And it's pretty simple stuff, right? So I'm pulling a main class off of my main page. I have a to-do item table. And we'll take a look at that table on the cloud in a moment. But as we know, this is what it looks like in code. It's async inserts. Again, I was talking about we can have multiple people doing inserts, just as we could have multiple applications on this device doing inserts into the service. So we want async so we don't end up blocking things over our pipe. And all of this was generated for me on the fly. And we have a couple of exception checkings, some inserts, and then we're popping exceptions if we need to. Very simple application. So let's try it. Let's get right to the amazing UI that I came up with. And this is the part where it does not fail to compile. Go get your compile. There we go. Registering application running from layout. There we go. So this is the easy landing page I have for the app. And this is the best effort I can do at UI. I don't make a lot of money becoming a UI designer anytime soon, as you can guess. So let's do a quick insert. So we'll call our first row create a demo. So let's click save. And what's happening behind the scenes is we're using notification services and our direct connection that already has my subscription ID for my cloud service that I created embedded in the code that will generate for me. And it's going to do an insert into my cloud database table. So save it goes. We have a notification that happens in the listening service, since it's async, that says, hey, there's been a new insert. Why don't you show the new insert? And that's create demo. Let's create a couple of different rows, demo 2. Oops. Let's try that again. There we go. Create demo 2. Save. Hey, it proves that it actually works local. And let's mark one of these complete, because that's the other thing we can do. We can have items that pop onto the list, and we can mark them complete. Mark that complete, and it freshes it up. So you'll note that I can use my mouse and the keyboard, and I can also use finger touch on the screen. Now, it's hard for you guys to see, but I'm actually touching the screen a couple of times, because we have built-in screen and touch capability for you guys, so you don't have to write it yourself or call that plumbing yourself. It's auto-generated for you. So let's flip back over to my website and take a look and see what the service thinks it has in it now. There's my file on Azure Day service. Oops, there we go. And let's take a look at the dashboard. So for those of you that haven't used Azure before, out of the box, we'll create some instrumentation for you to give you an idea on what's happening in your application. So you can see on the side here that there's some default information coming in. You can add custom counters if you want. These are the ones that we default put in for you. And we also do things now for the last month or so, like autoscale. So imagine this service was really, really busy, and the CPU that the SQL Server was running on was very, very hot, and the web service was quite busy dealing with the business logic. We will automatically create new instances for you, and you don't have to buy an application to do that. You don't have to build any very complicated management stuff to make that happen. And you can even include things like notifications. Like, go ahead and spin up a new site, but if the new site's still active an hour because it's still busy, you should probably send me a text, or send me an email, or send me a notification through the service that, okay, something weird is going on, you should look at this. So this is our sample dashboard. And let's take a look at the actual data. So we did a few things, but you recall that I created a new to-do item table. Here's our table. And inside of there, we should have just a very few rows. So I have an ID column, a text column, and a complete column. And complete is just a Boolean. And for my ID, it's 1, 2, and 3, and here's the three things I had. So you remember I clicked, this one was complete, so it went to true and went away. So that proved that the data got up to here. Let's prove that the data is also live on the other side and actually just delete a record here. And by the way, you can manage this database with SQL Server Management Studio, just as you would a database on your own machine or on your own server infrastructure. You would just put in a connection stream, and it would link in that data pool, the schema, and allow you to do all the updates, the CRUD operations that you would want to. So now we only have two rows. I delete the one that said create a demo tree. Let's flip back to our application. And let's hit refresh. Now we're down to create a demo. So what we showed was an easy way to create a very simple HTML5 C# application on the client, connects to a subscription in a secure way on the cloud, uses cloud databases and free website hosting, all this other stuff, to create a scalable application for you that at least initially is a single instance. Oh, can you go back to that? But what you can choose to do is to scale it. So let's take a quick look at the scale preview. And you can get an idea on how you would grow this over time. With a lot of cloud stuff today, you would have to create a new virtual machine, you would clone this one, you would deploy it, you would add it to an availability group, and then you would iterate and deploy from there. With us, it's a little bit different when you run something as simple as a scalable web service. I had one unit of work today. If I flip over to business and hit save, web is my free tier. I'll flip over to business because, okay, now I'm done playing with it. I think it's ready to go to shipment. It's almost completed. And now you can see that I have the capability to scale a little bit further. Oops. Okay. Sort of standard. And this is how you can scale. We just limited to 6. So I'm running currently under an MSDN account, which is limited on how many instances I can run. If you're running under a commercial account, obviously the sky's the limit for how many instances you want to scale to. And we also include the ability to link in things like identity and some other things. I think the next session you'll get a much deeper dive on the identity and notification services. But we've created a working application. It took us about 5 minutes. It's pretty cool. Let's see the page. I shut down the app so I don't block the local network. And back into our demo. No mail. Okay, so I talked about the store a little bit, so let me just move on quickly to kind of proof points for apps. So we've had the App Store for Windows 8 since Windows 8 launched, which was, gosh, 8 months ago, somewhere around there, 18 months. We've had a little over 100 million downloads in the first 2 months. Pretty good adoption on the app side. You guys know that number of apps is the most common way people report the quality of the store. One thing to realize is things like the iOS store, for example, 60% of the applications have never been downloaded. There are almost 1 million apps in the store. When you think 600,000 of them probably say hello world, or our flashlight applications, you get the idea on after a certain point, there's maybe 50 marquee applications that get a majority of the eyeballs, and it's difficult for anyone else to find your application until it gets to be one of those 50 applications. So the way of using stores is quite different today than it was even 2 years ago when there was only maybe 50,000 apps in an iOS store or a Play store or a Microsoft store. The idea of advertising yourself so your application can be found is a very important commercial consideration. And a lot of these guys have already very well-known brands that are landing in the store themselves. And they're trying to do that translation through ads, and they're trying to do it through actually pay-per-use applications. So we kind of talked a little bit about devices and how the cloud thing kind of is a chocolate and peanut butter. They go very well together, but they're quite different. Now we're going to talk about what is in the cloud that kind of makes it scalable, makes it something interesting to you guys to develop against. So the first is the cloud design point. So a design point is a fancy way of saying style. So cloud style includes a few things that are important and are quite different than doing things like virtualization. So the first thing cloud style needs to be able to do is to scale. You need to be able to scale on the fly. You need to be able to unscale on the fly. You need to be able to pay as you go. So rather than saying, I'm going to get a $50 license for something that I can deploy as many times as I want, the new business model would say, I'm going to deploy something and it's 5 cents an hour that I have it deployed. And if I don't want to use 5 cents an hour, I just stop deploying it. So it's a way to scale up on the tech side. It's a way to scale up on the business side as well. And the other big thing that is important is that you have a very common experience between what you write for cloud-style applications and what you're using on client applications. So there's easy connectivity between the two. So that's what we talk about when we say cloud design point. We talk about development choice. This is a hard one for a lot of people. So most of the cloud today is a one-way trip. It's toggle. It's kind of a light switch. I'm either in the cloud is a place, or I'm not in the cloud and I'm on a machine, or I'm in my own infrastructure, and that's also a place. It's easy to describe one place or the other place, but what we found is most people don't want or. Most people want and. So they want to be able to say, my web infrastructure is up on the cloud. My middle-tier business logic is at my infrastructure, and my database is under my desk. So making that work means you need to have common API sets, you need to have a common developer base across all those different places. And the way to do that is to make the place not matter, make the style what matters. So we've been working really hard on making sure the style is easy, the style is very understood. Like that dashboard we showed, it's really hard for a lot of people to deliver on because that dashboard we render is for your application, which you created less than 10 seconds ago, that is already generating signal information from the logs that we figured out where it presents to you across the internet on one single device. So that infrastructure times the 1,000 customers we add a day on Azure is kind of the scale that we're building for. This is a big surprise for a lot of people that we actually talk about open tech. A lot of people don't realize we have worked a lot with SAP and Oracle to actually have them offer their line of business systems in production supported on Azure with Java, with OpenJDK. We love some Node.js, Skype, the peer-to-peer video conferencing product that a lot of people use. It's about 300 million users. I think we're at 550 million hours a month of calls that happen on Skype. It's Node.js under the covers. We use Node. So server-side JavaScript is how we scale that service to cloud scale, which means we contribute a lot of code back to Node because you know what all code has in it? Bugs. And if you use the code, you need to check back in the bug fixes. So we're part of that open community on that side. And through virtual machines and a whole lot of other stuff, we offer Java support, we offer Penguin support through Linux, and we offer native support for Java as well, so even beyond the virtual machine. The last one up there you see, which is the funny elephant, is Hadoop. That's MapReduce, that's doing scale-out solution for solving large data sets. We partnered with the guys that create the Hadoop instances in the open source community. We are deploying that both on-premises with Hadoop on a server, like there's a setup at EXE that you install. And we also offer Hadoop as a service, which we call HD Insights. So you can do large petabytes worth of ingestion of new data from websites or logs or data sources, figure out the right information inside of there, so Hadoop is really good about parsing that information for you. And then you can take business decisions from that. So that's kind of the new data platform technologies, and I think we might even have some sessions around that later today. And this is not a mistake. We have Enterprise Ready with a Master Chief picture from Halo. We had about a year when we moved Halo in-house to Microsoft to 343 Studios. As part of that 1 year, they redid the entire technology infrastructure for Halo to do on-the-fly pattern matching for game style, for matching you up with the next player you want to play with, for leaderboards. We did the work to figure out how to do an artificial intelligence offload so that AI is smarter when it's connected to the cloud. And we tried to do a lot of work about monitoring cheating behavior. So we started with the basics. We just wanted the game to be a more fun game. Well, we turned a lot of what we learned there into how we're going to enable Xbox One to have three cloud services per game that you do. So in Xbox One, the game will look better when it's plugged in. We will pre-render some screens on the cloud and ship that to the client. We will have the AI offloaded for people that know how to write AI offload code. And we'll do some clever things about having background streaming capability for movies and cutscenes. So again, the game gets better, but you'll see more and more of that thinking bleed over into enterprise software over time. So the gaming world is leading a lot of what the enterprise does, but we're actually able to take advantage of that because we do the game and we do the enterprise. So enterprise ready for us is kind of critical because we run our core business processes on this stuff as well. So let's get specific. There's kind of different ways to think about the cloud. I'll hit this super fast because I'm hoping a lot of you guys have seen this before. But we have physical machines. We understand that virtualization is the gateway to cloud. So you can think of this as the logical barrier between probably 2007 and where you are today. So what happened to make physical go to virtual was the stock market crash. 2007 was a tough year. No one had any money. You weren't going to buy new hardware if you were lucky enough to have an application that was growing. So what you said was, I'm going to throw virtualization at it and get more people on one unit of hardware because that allows me better utilization, saves me money. So virtualization got us there. To virtualize at scale, you have to figure out identity. So now you got identity and virtualization figured out. And now if I can remove where those virtual machines are running from the list of stuff I care about, I now open up the possibility of infrastructure as a service. So now someone else can run my virtual machine for me, and through some simple web technologies like REST interface, I can control those things and have someone else manage the actual hardware for me. So someone else pays the power bill and pours the concrete, and I gain access to the scale unit that they have. So that's infrastructure. Here's kind of where it gets interesting. So you can think of this as cloud 1.0. If you have a native cloud written application, like you're starting a new application today, and you're going to design it to scale to an unknown level, because you hope it's a bunch, but you have to ship it, so you have to pick a number, you'll probably choose something that's state-free, that's web technology-friendly, that doesn't require a hard database connection, that's more scale-out in approach. And that's where you'll probably say platform as a service things become really interesting for me. And then this one, you'll see the green goes all the way across for software as a service. I can do beer as a service, right? So it's just a business discussion. It's not a technology discussion at all. So we had mainframes that did software as a service for forever. It was called time cards. Right? You say, I have an hour of compute time at my university. Well, that's mainframe as a service. It was just, you have an hour, and if your job isn't done in an hour, too bad, the next person gets the hour. Well, we're a little bit more fungible than that. It's more scalable than that today. But the same concept lives. Most people apply software as a service to things written at these two levels because they're more scalable, and software as a service generally implies, not always, but generally implies that it's a subscription model. So if you pay $15 a month or something, it implies that next month you may not want it anymore. So they can preserve costs a lot better by using the scale-out like infrastructure or platform. And this is why. This is what I call the why slide. Why would you choose one over the other one? So you can think of green, perfectly okay. It works. We've had client-server for 20 years. We've had mainframe for 50 years. We have cloud services since mid-90s or so. We've had SOA, service-oriented architecture, for probably the last 10. And now it's this new thing, and they just call it cloud. But really, it's the next version of service-oriented architecture. In a way, it is. In a way, it's quite different, because finally, the operations guys have caught up with the software guys. So you can think of green as being okay, but it's what you do. For the majority of the stuff, and I would argue for everything except applications and data, it's a waste of your time. If you're not working on your app code, or if you're not looking after your data and how to get more of it, make it better, make it cleaner, make it more about the customer, I would say you're wasting your time. A lot of times you have to waste your time because there's science involved, right? You have to make the physics of writing software work for you. But when you get to infrastructure as a service, you see these gains, right? You gain networking, storage, service, and virtualization free. Someone like where Rob works has to worry about that, or someone at Amazon has to worry about it, or someone at Google has to worry about it. But they're the ones that worry about those four boxes, allowing me to only have to care about patching, updating, deploying, writing, management software interfaces, and then figuring out how customer utilization is working. None of those things are in apps and data. But you get to do that, but at least you have more time to do it because you're not doing this stuff. Well, now you move to platform as a service, and you can see it's kind of where we want to be, right? I only care about my app or application. I only care about my data or someone else's data that integrates with my stuff, so app and data. And the last point, software as a service, I don't really care about anything because that's something I'm using. So anyone know the number one application for the internet today? What has won the internet? Any guesses? Video. The number one way people listen to music today is YouTube. Not me, but apparently the people have voted, and YouTube has won the radio, right? Well, and Netflix accounts for almost half of the network packets worldwide on an afternoon US time on Friday. So half of the utilization of the world is taken up by lazy Americans like me watching very bad movies. Video has won. The number one software as a service, so this is more a commercial thing, is search. And that's where we're a little bit more familiar because a lot of people use it for finding code snippets, or I want to look up a restaurant, or I want to see what that thing was my mom talked about. That's where I use search. But software as a service tends to be where most cloud applications go, especially if they're consumer apps. But when we go to platform as a service, don't make the mistake of assuming you have to change the way you make your money just because you changed the way you made your software. Ask your customer. That's always the right answer for things. And just know when you want to disagree with your customer. Was it Henry Ford made the comment that if I asked a customer what they wanted, they would still have a horse in front of the car. So at some point, you have to lead change, but you have to be smart about it. So let's get down into more of a geek point of view. We talked kind of the megatrends. I kind of explained where apps are going and how the explosion of devices make things very powerful, and that it's one of those things where a million people doing something makes something that isn't interesting, interesting. It's just the power of the eyeball changes the dynamics for how software is developed and how value is achieved. Well, we tried to carve out this kind of easy to understand mechanism, the things that matter if you wanted to build pretty much anything. So we spent a lot of time trying to figure out if we need more boxes, if these are too many boxes, if we should collapse these together. Well, I mean, we just make ourselves dizzy in revenue trying to figure out how many boxes there are to be because we love plumbing so much. So on the infrastructure side, these things you can choose to use from us for free if you use cloud, right? Those things should come. For many of you, you have applications that work on your own premises that you've written code for already. Those will continue to work because we provide infrastructure services, and that could be APIs, that could be licenses for things, that could be the ecosystem like the Broadcoms of the world that write Bluetooth stacks for people. Well, we give them APIs so they can write a good Bluetooth stack. When you move up to data services, that's probably, you probably multiply by 10 the number of developers who spend time, probably each level up. So when you get to data services, there's a lot of people that spend a lot of time worried about data. And again, to my earlier argument, it's about app and data. Here's your data, right? So SQL database, you can think as a structured data. It's the incumbent relational database thing. You think by tables and schemas and logs and pages. All that stuff is still true. You move to HDN site, and things get weird, right? You're dealing with masses and massive unstructured data. Probably when you get to a terabyte of stuff, 0.9 terabytes of stuff is things you don't care about. The 0.1 are the things you're really interested in figuring out and how you get between there. That's if I'm marrying up between SQL and HDN site. So I can use really clever querying techniques to pull from large segments of data really, really fast. And then we have to do something new here called tables. It's a pretty simple concept. It's rows and columns. If anyone of us has used Excel before, it's a table. What if I told you I could put a trillion rows in your table and I would give it to you for $10 a month? And what if I told you I could give you a trillion rows in your database and it'd be $10,000 a month? The database has a lot of really fancy relational technology inside of it. The table is just really big and really cheap. And then what if I told you Microsoft announced just yesterday that we're going to go with a whole cache service that will shove all this in RAM as fast as we can anyway? I'll take the table. So tables over time will be taking a lot of the workload away from databases because Because as we all know, if we're really honest about it, most of the time, unless we have a large data warehouse project, our database is a really good cache engine. The first thing a database does when you do a query is pull as many things as it can into memory that's close to what you asked for, in the hopes that the next thing you ask for is going to be close to that. It's a caching technology. Because memory was expensive, disks were slow, the idea was to get RAM as fast as you can. The whole purpose of the cloud is to have everything disk-free as fast as we can anyway. So be thoughtful about the places, again, where I talk about backup. You can say, well, why am I doing this anymore? Databases sometimes should be reconsidered. A lot of cases, databases are awesome. Online transaction systems, things that need to be immediately available, you have 200 millisecond query performance time kind of requirements, SLAs. Databases are awesome because they've been doing that for 20 years. But when you think table, and as long as I get the answer within, you know, a second, 2 seconds, but it's a decimal place cheaper and easier to create things with, okay, let's talk about some tables. So the last thing on there is blob storage. So if I, in row, if my table said I can store 2 gigabytes on each row of that table, and then I can give you segment access to like an offset in that blob source, so I can start at minute 37 of the video, or I can start at 12 seconds in, or I can integrate on the fly into the row of things by doing smart things around pointer management that we'll do for you. Blobs become really, really interesting ways to store large masses of data until you can shred that into your HD Insight and then do a reporting with SQL. So you see how we're trying to line up the data services there. And really, the top portion is where we've been as developers, unless you're a database guy, and thank you for coming to the database. Many of you don't get outside much. But on the app services side, this is where many of us have spent our careers. So how do I handle worrying about websites? A lot of you guys probably spend a lot of time looking at a JavaScript editor, and you realize just how little fun that is most of the time because JavaScript's hard. Especially if you're doing complicated async kind of operations, JavaScript's quite difficult. The tooling has gotten a little bit better, but it's still much harder than it is to do something similar in C# or another more managed language set. But we're trying to make these things much easier to do. And you'll see a mix on the app services side, by the way, between things that are code-driven and things which are just, let me have 4 of those. Let me give you an example. When we look at HPC, that's high-performance computing. Let's say your application needs to do protein folding analysis. You're in pharmaceuticals. You don't want to create a whole application that figures out how to schedule, how to run on sheet metal, how to run high-performance scenarios on things with a lot of operating system in the middle. What we're going to do is offer high-performance computing as a service that will automatically generate the scheduling script, that will deploy it to multiple machines that are ready to work on your problem set, and it will handle the reporting and handling things that don't work where you have code problems. So high-performance computing has been around, gosh, 35 years since the mainframe. That was the original mainframe workload. They figured out they needed more, so they created scale out. Perfect workload for the cloud. And it's something that most of you use turnkey. You just say, I want 4 clusters of high-performance computing, and I need it for 3 hours per day. But it's also something you could extend if you want to. So you could build infrastructure services, data services, and app services, boxes of your own. And that's an important thing I want to make clear to you guys is, this is a platform that we run that we offer services against. You can create your own as well. So if you've got deep domain expertise in manufacturing supply chain, we would love to have you guys generate supply chain applications. So this is the way to stitch things together. And our value prop is we'll give you access to markets worldwide. So the last thing I want to leave you guys with is a local example. So some of you guys may know Magby in the magazine business. They're using both Windows on the client side and Azure on the server side to do a couple of things. So one of the big things they get access to is new markets because they don't have to buy servers in every country they want to go to. That's part of the value for the cloud. One of the things you guys might know is that we're the only company, at least currently, that is in mainland China with their primary cloud services. So we have Windows Azure in mainland China, we have it in Singapore, and we also have it local in Hong Kong, as well as Europe and US as well. So the idea is that we're trying to light up as much as, in particular for you guys, the mainland China becomes interesting given the supply chain between people that consume things that you make and the things that you consume things from that other people make. So that is a very interesting scenario for you guys to be aware of. So I think I've covered a lot and I've talked fast. So I'm more than happy to address any questions. That's my Twitter handle. I'm going to try to be modern and not give you my email, but it's Rumcraft at Microsoft, if you'd rather email. let's keep the discussion going. I really look forward to feedback on how the day goes for you guys. So thank you all for your attention, and I'm very pleased that I have the opportunity to speak with you. Thank you.